This is DomesticPreparedness.com. Since 1998, Domestic Preparedness has been a source of solutions for the professional preparedness community. Your host today is the managing editor, John Morton.
Today's interview is brought to you by Integrated Warehousing Solutions, the nation's leading provider of ERMIS emergency preparedness solutions. With easy-to-use solutions ranging from day-to-day inventory, asset, donations, and program management, to the rapid deployment, mobile emergency response solutions for field operations, RSS, POD, and patient tracking, ERMIS Solutions brings control, accuracy, and visibility. For more information, call 1-800-682-2910. Domestic Preparedness is with Joe Becker, the Senior Vice President for Preparedness and Response at the American Red Cross. As we all know, the National Response Plan is in revision as the National Response Framework and is now in release for public comment. The Red Cross is a major player in ESF-6 for mass care, emergency assistance, housing, and human services, and ESF-8 for public health and medical services. But its roles are changing. And we're going to talk with Joe about that. And as September is also National Preparedness Month, we're going to address that topic as well. Joe, thanks for hosting us. It's great to be back for our second audio interview here at the Red Cross National Headquarters in Washington.
Welcome back.
Well, let's start with the brief on the Red Cross response, concept of operations for disaster preparedness and response. In DOD jargon, what is your CONOPS?
Our CONOPS is one of layering of scale. We respond first with our local chapters. We have about 750 local units. They have disaster teams 24/7 on duty. We respond to about 200 disasters a day. If the disaster is larger than the local chapter can handle, we have the country divided into 8 regions. They bring resources, people, equipment from the nearest chapters. If it's larger than a region can handle, then we do it nationally. On an annual basis, we'll do about 50 disasters that require the whole Red Cross resource base. And I guess the other concept of operations issue we have is the Red Cross. As a nonprofit, we're the disaster response voluntary organization that doesn't pick and choose which disasters we're going to show up at. Is it big enough? Is it in the right location? Or do we have enough money in the bank? We respond anytime there's a human need.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, the Red Cross speaks of response to any disaster within a 2-hour time frame. Now, can you tell us how the local chapters are able to do that?
Sure. They have teams of volunteers called disaster action teams. They're 24/7. There's a fire in the middle of the night or a small flood or whatever. That's who gets the first call. We're typically called, as you know, by local fire. Mm-hmm. And they'll give us the notice. And in most cases, before the firefighters leave that operation, the mm-hmm. Red Cross volunteers are there. We try for a nice handoff from the firefighters to the Red Cross. And then other scenarios would vary, but that's the basic concept of operations.
Now, how do the local chapters link with the volunteers in the Medical Response Corps, the MRCs? That's where the linkage would happen, right?
Sure. It's done predominantly at the local unit. It depends on who is sponsoring the Medical Reserve Corps. Mm-hmm. Typically, that's a public health department. Mm-hmm. And so we wicker with the public health folks to work with them. It's a great partnership. And particularly on the sheltering side, or a disaster where there's more medical need or human suffering, it's a great partnership.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are the Red Cross linkages at the state level?
We would be present in the state EOC, emergency mm-hmm. management, and in 14 key risk states where we are combining natural risk and man-made risk, we have year-round full-time presence in the state EOCs. In the rest, we have teams that are trained that rotate in. Mm-hmm. If money was no object, I'd have somebody full-time in all 50 states and in mm-hmm. each territory's EOC.
Now then, working up to the regional level, you have Red Cross staff at FEMA regional offices. Tell us what the National Response Framework now details in this regard.
The framework doesn't speak to that. The annex for ESF-6 notes it or makes mm-hmm. mention of it. That's new post-Katrina, and that goes back to it's not just a Red Cross thing. The middle of a disaster is a heck of a time to get to know somebody. And we wanted people full-time year-round in the FEMA regions that could then deploy with the FEMA region staff in time of disaster and have those relationships solid ahead of time. Mm-hmm. That was one of our learnings from Katrina.
I see. Now, then, at the federal level, you liaise with a number of the support agencies, the Departments of Agriculture, Defense, Housing and Urban Development, Treasury, and Veterans Affairs. How do you manage that, and what capabilities does each bring to the table as it relates to you all?
We have a separate team that works with our federal partners. And command and control, the operating team is not under them. They don't give direction to the operating team. They're there to execute our responsibilities under the National Response Plan, or NRF, and to work with our federal partners. They don't direct sheltering, feeding, or, mm-hmm. or things like that on the ground. That's a separate dedicated team. Our clearest partners are FEMA, DHS, HHS, with HUD taking a more active role in the housing side. We're working more closely with them on the handoff from a shelter to longer-term housing needs. Mm-hmm. But we have full-time dedicated paid staff that do that, which is a little bit different than our business model, where almost all of our work is typically done by volunteers.
I see. Now, the organizational changes that the National Response Framework has brought to the Red Cross with regard to the preparedness and response mission, they're different now, right? The NRF and the revision, you've got slight changes there as regards to your responsibilities and whether you're supporting or leading.
It changes our role in the NRF. It doesn't, you spoke of mission, and it doesn't mm-hmm. really change our mission. We do seven things in disaster times, and at times we stand criticized for unrealistic expectations that we meet all needs. Mm-hmm. I mean, we feed people, we shelter people, we distribute bulk items with fixed sites or mobile sites, you know, the rakes and shovels and comfort kits and things people need. We do mental health. Our nurses do disaster health. We do client casework, and sometimes that involves giving funds or debit cards to clients. And then we do family connectedness. Those services are operated on a volunteer-led, delivered basis. Our role in the NRF, in fact, in internal Red Cross parlance, we sometimes call it our Fed Cross team and our Red Cross team, the team that does the NRP or the new NRF. That's a separate team that's more of a coordinating. They make commitments on behalf of the organization, but trust me, they're doing that under the direction of the actual operators, which are a separate team.
Mm-hmm. Now, turning specifically to ESF 6, the Red Cross has become an ESF 6 support agency for mass care. Now, how is this different than it was under the National Response Plan, or at least the annex there?
I think the key issue for us as the NRF was moving forward was when the state makes a request of the federal government for resources in time of disaster, the people on the receiving end of that request have to have the authority to commit federal resources. Mm-hmm. In the old framework, we were on the receiving end of a state request for mass care resources. We were weighing in on that request. We were grounding it with what we were doing. Ultimately, that request was given to FEMA for the right use within the federal mm-hmm. framework. We've got to be faster. We've got to have a higher degree of accountability, and I think the federal system needs to be more responsive to the state folks making the request. It became very clear that we don't have the authority to commit federal resources. Mm-hmm. If the state says, look, we need ice, we need water, we need X, we need Y, we can be on the receiving end of that and hand it to FEMA, but FEMA has mm-hmm. the authority to commit the federal government. Mm-hmm. We're a federal instrumentality, but we're not a federal agency. We don't receive funding from government typically for disasters. We're not part of government, but we work very closely with government. Mm-hmm. And I think that distinction has gotten a sharper focus in the new framework, where we've tried to be very clear about what we can do and then clearer about what authority we don't have within the federal structure.
Mm-hmm. I see. What about with regard to ESF-8?
The roles are basically the same, but you know there's been a lot of attention to, and I don't want to use words that carry too much meaning here, but special need shelters mm-hmm. or special shelters or medical temporary infirmary facilities. Different local governments are using now different words to describe people that we used to all just lump in and say folks with special needs. Our roles in ESF-8, they're on an operational level. We provide first aid, typically in our sheltering facilities. We provide counseling. We have thousands of mental health professionals who donate their services with us. We support temporary medical facilities. We do something like what you would call hoteling. You know, mm-hmm. we want to provide the medical care, and we support that. Then obviously we have a key role with the nation's blood supply, and mm-hmm. we work with the AABB, American Association of Blood Banks, on that. We're a support agency in six ESFs. Six and eight tend to get most of the work, but mm-hmm. we bring value where we can to the federal structure. Mm-hmm.
In this segment, let's look specifically now at sheltering. Let's start with the National Shelter System, the NSS. For those who might not know about this program, would you tell us what it is and how the Red Cross supports it?
Sure. As you know, sheltering information is a precious commodity. How many people do we have? Where do we have them? And in the normal construct, a county reports to the state, or county or parish reports to the state. The state reports up to the federal system. And each state has its own way, oftentimes its own software, its own method of collecting that data. And, you know, when Katrina hit, Red Cross was sheltering in 27 states. We had people dispersed all over the country with different data systems and different ways to collect that information and report it to FEMA. And one of the key things that was recognized was we need a national shelter data system. That was in the White House findings post-Katrina. It was clearly an objective for FEMA. The Red Cross, we contracted out and created a national shelter data system. We've since given it to FEMA. It's populated first. There's about 47,000 shelters in there. Most of those, almost all of those, I think 45,000 of them are the Red Cross shelters. Now we're working really hard to bring partner shelters into that. If a local church is recognized by local emergency management as a shelter, we want that in the data system as well. And what we're really trying to do, and we've used this pretty aggressively on recent disasters, we can give real-time information on how many people we have as of the last census count that day, how many people we have, where they are. And it's not as important when you have a very local disaster that's confined to a few counties or certainly confined within a state. But when you have multiple state response, being able to get good data, grounded data, and aggregate it quickly is important. So that's what we are trying to mm-hmm. create.
Now, you mentioned the specialized shelters, and that was an issue that came out in the ESF-8 discussions. What support does the Red Cross provide for those? How do you define them, and how are they different than medical shelters?
Well, they're defined in various ways in various local plans. And our key customer here, our quarterback, is still the county or parish emergency manager. I mean, that's whose control we work under in time of disaster. And frankly, that's who declares a shelter. The Red Cross just doesn't show up at a high school gym and say, here we are, and it's now a shelter. That's obviously mm-hmm. emergency management's function. I think we as an organization have needed to change. I think we've been too quick to say, oh, you're a special needs client. You belong in a special needs shelter, which mm-hmm. would typically then be run by public health or in some cases the local hospital. We've been too quick to exclude people from the congregate shelter because they appear to have special needs. Whereas our whole focus now is to try to keep as many people as we can in the congregate shelter. I mean, we've worked real hard with disabilities folks. The fact that you have a disability doesn't automatically mean you belong in a special needs shelter. Now, you ground this with the fact that the people that we're sheltering in a disaster, you know, first of all, typically somewhere between 90 to 93, 95% of people in disaster take care of themselves. They go stay with mom. They check mm-hmm. into a motel. We're dealing with the people who don't have another option. They're older than the population as a whole. They're less healthy than the population as a whole, and they're poorer than the population as a whole. And so they present a wide range of needs. We've worked very closely with HHS in the last year to create a better intake triage method to make sure that we're putting the right people in the congregate shelter, and we're asking for support from special needs shelters, from the people who truly have special medical needs. Being in a wheelchair is not a special medical need, and we want to make sure we can accommodate you in the congregate shelter, for example.
Mm-hmm. Joe, with respect to the non-conventional shelters like ships, tent cities, hotel-motel arrangements, and any other group shelter facilities, can you tell us a little bit about how the Red Cross supports the FEMA management of those options?
Clearly, when we get into a disaster of that scale where those options are on the table, FEMA takes the lead, particularly with the new ESF-6 construct in planning for those, and they would typically contract those out. You're talking about a cruise ship or you're talking about a hotel motel. The Red Cross executed the motel program, the motel sheltering, in the earliest weeks of Katrina. We did that. FEMA asked us to take that for them in the earliest weeks until they were ready to take that program over. But even that one going forward, FEMA intends to be the one to execute that program and to contract for it. Our role is to be very clear, working with counties, working with states on who we have, where we have them, where we have capacity issues. Then we jointly all need to talk about where are people going and where are the needs manifesting themselves, so that if these options come on the table, we can all jointly plan. And sure, the Red Cross would stand ready to help support those with people, support those with supplies or equipment. But I think we've got some good, clear delineation in the last couple of years around FEMA's role and FEMA's acceptance of that responsibility.
Mm-hmm. What about the provision for pet evacuation and sheltering?
Boy, if there was a national answer to pet sheltering, I'm not sure we would all need to be here. That's one of the thorniest issues. That's a local concern. And I think the Red Cross has recognized that we need to step up to a better role. It's not enough for the Red Cross to say, we can't accept pets in our shelters because the health department won't let us. That's an accepted fact, but we need to then move to how do we accommodate pets in an evacuation scenario. Mom and Dad aren't going to leave if they can't take Rover, and we want them to leave. When emergency management or the mayor says get out, we want them to go. So what we've been trying to do, and we've asked our chapters to do, is absent a community solution already, be the convener. Bring people around in the community who care about this issue, who might bring value to the issue, and the solutions that are emerging are maybe the high school gym is the congregate shelter and the pet shelter is set up in a facility in the parking lot or set up an adjacent facility. We want mom and dad to be very close to the pets. We obviously for allergies and public health reasons, we can't have the pets in the shelters, but we should be trying to wicker the human sheltering with the pet sheltering and have that be one cohesive plan, community by community. And as I look at the nation's sheltering movement over the last couple of years, we're seeing good progress here. Mm-hmm. And we've had a lot of disasters in the last months where pet shelter agreements have been activated, the pets are taken care of, the people are taken care of, and it's a whole new cadre of volunteers that we need to bring in who care deeply about pets. And if asked, they're very willing to become part of the solution. We just need to bring them into the planning process long before the disaster hits.
Mm-hmm. In this segment, let's talk about Red Cross support beyond sheltering. Certainly, the temporary housing needs include not just sheltering, but also the access to medical facilities. And I guess these are the temporary infirmaries and the immunization clinics and the morgues and hospitals and nursing homes. Joe, tell us a little bit about what the Red Cross provides in this regard.
I think it's a couple of different levels here. The first piece is, we spoke about it a bit ago, but let's make sure we have the right people in the right places. And that's a huge information issue at a time when phones aren't working and communications are hard. But as we're triaging people and where do you belong, making sure they're in the right places. Then when you get into actual medical facilities, the Red Cross doesn't provide that medical care. That's under public health or the hospital or whoever the local solution is. But we stand ready to help. We stand ready to help supply it. If it's a high school gym that's now a temporary medical facility, we stand ready to help with the hoteling behind that. But the actual provision of medical care, the record keeping on the patients, that's a health issue. That's why that coordination ahead of time between emergency management and public health, we support that. We want to be part of that. And we also want to be real clear about what we don't do in that regard. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is going to be first and foremost in a pan flu environment. Mm-hmm. And as we all continue that planning towards pan flu, we need great clarity around who has what role and who has what responsibility community by community.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about regard to public transportation and schools and employment opportunities and the other social services when the evacuations are to the distant locations? What support does the Red Cross provide here?
Obviously, our role in that type of evacuation is to be on the receiving end and to have adequate capacity on the receiving end. And so the planning process up front is what's so important. How many shelter spaces do we have in this county? How many shelter spaces do we have in the state? What's our capacity to run them? And oftentimes the limiting factors are twofold. It's first of all, number of facilities. And we're constantly looking for more in some key critical parts of the country where we know today if the worst case scenario happens, we in emergency management have not identified enough public buildings to be congregate shelters. And we've moved in the last years to more of the mega shelter concept, if we can, where a larger city's convention center or the arenas. We have an agreement now with the Arena Managers of America where we want to go to having a backstop of quite large facilities if we can. And obviously, there's some reimbursement issues on the mega facilities with FEMA and some thorny issues there that we still need to work out. Once we've got the number of facilities nailed down and actually active, surveyed, in the database, we know we can staff them and we know how we're going to run them, then it becomes an information flow on who do we have where so that we on the receiving end can say, look, we're full here, we're full over here, now let's move the people over there. That type of communication in the middle of a disaster is a tough thing, and that's where the planning ahead of time needs to be done. You know, and we all talk about it in our response community here. With it. The plan is just, it's important for the relationships, and it's also important for all of us to know what we're deviating from when the disaster actually happens. We need the plans, and then we need the flexibility and the relationships to make better decisions on the fly.
Well, you've mentioned information. There is a disaster welfare information system that you all are developing or have in place. Can you tell us a little bit about how that works from the standpoint of patient tracking and also with regard to cataloging, if you will, your congregate shelters availability?
Sure. First, on the people side, this is one of the things that we literally stood up within a few weeks during Katrina. Rather than knocking on doors of facilities to see who we have where, working with our federal partners and state partners and local partners, we shifted the thinking to how can we help people connect themselves? And what we stood up is what we call the Safe and Well website. And hundreds of thousands of people during Katrina ended up using this. You go to redcross.org or it's phone-based if you don't have access to a computer where you are. And there's a lot of privacy around this that we had to respect, but you're basically saying, It's pre-populated with messages. I'm Joe Becker, and I'm safe in this shelter, and I'll call you when I'm able to. And there's pre-scripted messages, and I just pick which message I want. Mm-hmm. I'm with mom, or I'm in a motel, or I'm in a shelter. I've got the kids, or whatever. And then there's a search side that says, I'm looking for Joe Becker. And what we're trying to do is help people match themselves. And it was very successful during Katrina. It took a while to aggregate disparate efforts, and we got great help from Microsoft and UC San Diego to make this thing come together. That's now the model. And when you look at the new NRF framework, and particularly I work with HHS on a medical side, HHS wants to move towards this Safe and Well concept again, because we've got to help people connect themselves when we get into operations that are on that kind of scale. Mm-hmm. Knocking on doors just isn't going to get there.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about on the side of the cataloging the congregate shelters? You talked about the people side, the information system that supports that. How does that work?
What we have in place with the National Shelter System is how many people we have and where they are. What we don't have as a country is where is John Smith? Where was John Smith last night? FEMA's working really hard on that. They're actually involving some of the military assets because they've got some things that might bring value to this. But FEMA takes that as their task on how do we keep track of you as you evacuate, particularly in a medical context. And we've done it right in some communities where they're a little further along with the wristbanding of people and how do we barcode you as you move around. But we don't have yet a national solution to that. And that's one of the things on FEMA's big plate of projects right now.
Now, some of the other support activities you mentioned were things like feeding as a component of mass care. What's your role here, and tell us about the major stockpiling program that you've instituted.
Sure. In the earliest days of a disaster, we're caring about the basic human needs, and food and shelter and giving people the basic items is real important. We will be there with a feeding operation. It will be feeding people in shelters. It will be either setting up fixed feeding sites in a community that people can come to, or mobile feeding sites. Those are those Red Cross trucks you see driving through neighborhoods. We'll literally divide the community into a route and feed two meals a day mobile. And usually it's a combination of all three, mm-hmm. a fixed site, a mobile site, and then separate feeding in the shelters. The difference in feeding is there are a lot of community organizations who take who have a great capacity to provide food and a great capacity to help distribute that food. So what we need to do is work with who comes to the table. Well, we'll usually be joined on some larger disasters by usual partners, the faith-based groups, the churches, the Salvation Army will be there, the Southern Baptist, the men's group will be there certainly. But one of the lessons we learned in Katrina was we have good relationships with our usual partners in feeding, but what about all the non-disaster organizations that step forward and want to help? And some of that was also on the sheltering side. When the communications were down and roads were clogged, and then the EOC, the sheltering and feeding that was presumed to be happening was what the Red Cross was providing and what some of our usual partners were providing. Well, the pastor that with a key and four volunteers that opened up the church kitchen and opened up the mm-hmm. church hall and became a shelter and a feeding operation, they just fatigued after a few days. Mm-hmm. So one of our, we had two real key lessons from Katrina as an organization. One was on our capacities. The bigger one for us was on our partnerships with non-disaster organizations. Your emergency manager doesn't want to deal with 15 different nonprofits in the EOC, particularly in time of disaster. That's not the time to try to coordinate something like that. What we're trying to do in the Red Cross side, we're not going to ever take a command and control stance with other nonprofits, you know, telling people where to put their kitchen and telling people where to mobilize their teams. It has to be done in a collaborative way. And that's what we've been about since Katrina, is bringing faith communities, civic groups, people into the community's disaster operation, not to help the Red Cross be better, but to help the community's response mm-hmm. grow. Mm-hmm. So the partnership piece has been the harder piece for us. We've gotten great traction where there have been recent disasters. We've gotten less traction from organizations that we've asked where there haven't been recent disasters. Then the response is often, well, when something happens, call us and we'll see if we can come. Well, no, we need to know ahead of time who you can come and what capacity you can bring. And we need to sit down with an emergency manager and quantify our capacities, quantify our partners' capacities, and create realistic expectations on what we can do, and realistic expectations on when would we locally and the Red Cross be over our head, and we'd be bringing in Red Cross resources from adjacent communities that might take a few hours to get there, or if it's national resources, might take a few days to get there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the blood and blood products and your coordination with the American Association of Blood Banks, their task force. Tell us about the relationship you have with the task force and what you both bring to the table.
This is a great relationship, and it's so important. What we're all trying to do here is understand the hospital's need for blood. What is happening in the community? What is the injury fatality situation? And then gauge the demand for blood with the hospitals so that we, not just the Red Cross, but we and other smaller local community blood banks can be on the right message. Do we need people to give blood right now? Mm-hmm. Do we not need people to give blood right now? Mm-hmm. And how do we communicate clearly how much blood we need and when we have enough to meet mm-hmm. the demands of this particular disaster? That was actually a key learning out of 9/11 for us as a country. And we needed to do a better job, all the blood banks coming together to be on the right message. Now, clearly the Red Cross, we're about half the nation's blood supply, but there are a lot of partners in this, and the AABB is the umbrella organization over that, and their task force is who's written into the NRF, was written into the NRP, really providing that value in ESF-8. So mm-hmm. it's the AABB task force that's kind of that coordinating mechanism, and we're a big player there, but we work under that umbrella.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of bulk distribution of emergency relief items, how does that work?
It works in different ways in different disasters. What we're trying to do, it's a lot like the feeding. We'll set up fixed sites where we're giving away stuff, and then we do mobile routes. And again, it's those Red Cross trucks, and it's everything from rakes and shovels and garbage bags to toiletry kits and cleanup kits and things like that. We try real hard in the Red Cross not to be the organization that tells America, send us what's in your closet right now, or empty out your dresser and send us your used underwear. That's just the disaster within the disaster, as obviously the folks that are listening to this would know. We have pre-standing relationships with companies where we can say, I need 10 tractor trailer loads of this and 20 tractor trailer loads of that, and it comes. Typically, the smaller quantity in-kind donations are often worked the faith community side. And what we in the Red Cross want to do is not say no when somebody wants to give us used clothing, for example. We want to tell them who is taking it so that they can do that if that's their way they want to help in a disaster. On the national response framework and on a federal level, FEMA has that coordination of the volunteers and the in-kind donations. But we have to bring great value to that, and the other national organizations need to help FEMA in that process. VOAD is a great umbrella organization, and we have a lot vested in the success of VOAD and support them very strongly. The management of volunteers and the management of donations is just one of the toughest nuts in time of disaster. And the extent to which we can all sit down ahead of time and have written clear expectations of who's going to do what, who's going to bring what value, that's how it works. I'm not sure a federal organization is going to bring the value that is needed on the community's plan. This is a community issue, and we have to have our Red Cross as part of that part of that answer. And if there isn't one locally, we need to help bring the right people to the table to help craft that answer with the local emergency manager.
In terms of coordinating the volunteers and managing them, tell us a little bit about your thoughts for the Red Cross on credentialing folks.
It's something that I know in our community's been had varying levels of traction over time. There's great work being done now. We see on that, and I guess where we sit in a disaster, we're not inside the ropes in the Red Cross. We're not that response community. We're outside the ropes. If we're trying to get everybody out of an area, we're where we're sending everybody to. We're not in the hot zone, for example. Mm-hmm. So credentialing is important to us. We want to be part of a national solution on credentialing. We're grateful that local emergency managers recognize our Red Cross credentialing, and we think we do a pretty good job of making sure our people are ID'd with the right Red Cross credentialing. But we recognize there needs to be a national solution for this. Mm-hmm. We also recognize the need to make sure that we internally have our own discipline around our volunteers, and they don't just assign themselves to an operation and show up and go into the wrong places. And we work pretty hard at that to make sure that we're operating under the command and control of the incident commander. We're listening very closely to where we should be set up and where we should not be set up. And then we agree we want to be part of a credentialing effort nationally to make sure that our people are recognized and allowed to go where they need to be.
Now, the last question in this segment, I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier about first aid assistance and mental health counseling assistance. Tell us a little bit about the work you're doing there.
You know, the work of the Red Cross is done by volunteers, and some of our volunteers are good-hearted people who just want to help, and we train them up, and we have 20-something different functions that they're all trained in. Other volunteers that we have are highly skilled people that we help volunteer in a disaster environment. Mental health professionals from a community, nurses from a community, healthcare professionals, they know how to do what they do. Our education and our trainings are around how do you apply your skills to a disaster environment. We've got about 3,500 mental health professionals nationally, and we have about 4,500 health services or nurses predominantly that we use. And let's be real clear, when our nurses are in our shelters or they're on the feeding lines or working where we're set up, we're not providing advanced medical care here. Mm-hmm. We're working with the medical providers in the community. We're doing the first aid, and then we're also just kind of taking each of these people who present themselves, who are sicker than the norm and less well off than the norm, and we're trying to find local community solutions. That's not to say we didn't do things during Katrina that were kind of out of our lane. We had pharmacies in our shelters. We were doing things that clearly were beyond our normal protocols. The medical side for the health services that we provide, we have to coordinate very closely with local public health, and we want them to be the quarterback, and we want them to be the one to make sure that we're doing what we need to be doing and part of a greater system. Mm-hmm. On the mental health side, these are professional mental health counselors. Many of them are psychiatrists, psychologists. They'll close their practice, close their shop, and volunteer for the Red Cross. We only ask them to come a week, whereas our normal volunteers are 3 weeks. And even if you put it on the scale of Katrina, we provided mental health counseling to more than 800,000 people along the Gulf Coast. That was more than our 3,500 mental health professionals. That was a lot of people joining us and becoming part of that. The health services, the non-advanced medical care, we were providing that to almost 500,000 people during Katrina. So the scale of this thing, we obviously take a lot of spontaneous, well-skilled people and bring them into the system, and obviously work with very closely with the Medical Reserve Corps and try to make that system as robust as it can be. These are volunteers that get out of their bed in the middle of the night and respond. And I got to tell you, I'm so grateful that emergency management recognizes that volunteers are a key part of the response. Yeah, sometimes it's like herding worms, and it's tough to make sure that we've got it in a coordinated fashion. And that's the role of the Red Cross and some of our partner agencies. We need to make it easy for an emergency manager to have volunteers be a key component of the community's disaster response, and that's our job.
Mm-hmm. In this segment, I want to talk a little bit about Katrina and Rita and Wilma response, and in particular, I'd be interested in you developing a little bit some of the lessons learned you had from working with your corporate partners, in particular, the Southern Baptists and Walmart, and any other thoughts you have on lessons learned several years out that came from those three disasters.
I would say the key lessons learned for the Red Cross and Katrina, there were many, but two key ones. The first one was, where were our systems and our capacities not big enough? When we had the disaster that was 15 or 20 times bigger than the biggest we had ever done, where did our systems not serve us well? And by service systems, I'm actually speaking more on the internal side. Where did our IT systems not hold up well? Where did our supply chain not have the robust capacities that it needed? And the second lesson for us was partnerships. And I spoke a little bit about that before, but how well did we have good, realistic, and firmed up local partnerships, particularly with non-disaster organizations? And if I can go back to I'll take each of those. The capacity one, we gave ourselves until the hurricane season 06. We had about a four-month intense time where we executed a lot of projects, spent a lot of money to get ready for the following hurricane season. On the supply chain, we set a new bar, and we said, okay, during Katrina, Rita, Wilma, for example, we sheltered about 3.4 million people nights. The most we had in a shelter any one night was about 150,000. We now have on hand in warehouses what it takes to shelter 500,000 people and feed them for the first 6 days with prepackaged meals. So we went out and we bought another 500,000 cots, another 500,000 blankets, and all the supplies that would support that. We got another 1.5 million square feet of warehouse space. We now have 35 warehouses. Each Gulf state, each Atlantic Coast state, and then our other risk states have their own pre-positioned warehouse facilities now where it's closer to where we would need the items. We looked at, I spoke about our IT systems. One of the things we do for clients, when the economy starts to recover and people can start to get out and move around, we do casework with clients. And part of that is, we give away what they need. And we've learned over the years that, for things like clothes or shoes where size matters or gas for the car, it's more efficient for us to give people a debit card where they can go buy those things themselves. During Katrina, Rita, Wilma, we gave 1.4 million families an average of about $1,000 a family. It was about $1.5 billion, which for us was just a scope and scale. The biggest we had ever done before that, It was actually the year before, in the four hurricanes that hit Florida, we gave 73,000 families financial assistance, and we thought that was huge, and we set our IT systems for 100,000. After that, we made sure we were ready for 100,000. One of my earliest memories of Katrina was the night it was hitting, our assessment folks coming to me and saying, we're not going to be giving financial assistance to 70,000 or 100,000 families. We think it's going to be between 800,000 and 1.2 million. Yeah. Our systems weren't going to work. A volunteer in a high school gym working one-on-one with a family, we knew at that point it wasn't going to work. We called 14 or 15 tech companies, locked them in our headquarters. I sat them down. I said, you have 4 days to create a whole new way of doing this. Our thinking was, who can move money like Western Union around the country? And we stood up the call centers, and we did what we did on the ground. And I'll tell you what, as big as it was, we were too slow. We had lines, the call centers that we stood up, there were lines, wait on the phone of hours trying to get through, and there were massive lines, and the local law enforcement did an amazing job just trying to keep order around where we were. I mean, when you open up a door and say, well, Red Cross is giving away free money to anybody who's got disaster cause need, imagine the result of that, and that's what we had during Katrina and Rita Wilma. And oh, by the way, the IT systems that we had stress tested to 100,000 families literally fell apart at about 130, 140,000. So we had to create a whole new parallel system at the same time. Today, or actually by last hurricane season, we had call centers ready to go to handle many times that scale. Our IT system can handle a 2 million family, disaster and be on scale with that. It's systems like that, our supply chain, our IT system, our internal systems, where what was accomplished in a four-month period of time with a lot of corporate help was pretty phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back on it, that was the easier of the two lessons learned for us. You know, buying things and building things was a lot easier than the relationship piece. And some of this is a cultural change for the Red Cross. You know, for example, you open up a shelter, and we're liable for what happens in there. And we have a lot of procedures and a lot of rules. And I think too often at times, we act like it's our shelter with our people and our procedures and our stuff. And we've kind of had to wake up as an organization and say, no, this is the community's shelter. This is the community's disaster. And organizations that we used to have come in and give us advice, help us with our training, help us with our manuals, help us get our people ready, we've turned it upside down and we've said, no, please become part of this response. If you speak a certain language, if you're geographically in a certain part of the community that's hard to get to, we need you as a partner to be with us in the community's response. And so, and everybody kind of looked at us as an organization and said, well, I'll believe that when you show me the money. And we literally had to change our business model and say, now if a partner organization, and we firm up the arrangements ahead of time, but if you'll shelter, and do it in concert with the emergency management, in concert with the Red Cross, we'll pay those expenses and we'll make you whole for having done that. We now have a lot of community partners who are changing who we are. And I think, that's longer, it's going to take us a longer period of time, but that's a more fundamental change in the Red Cross to make sure that we're where we need to be very quickly with people from the community very quickly who speak the right language, who understand the community, rather than being so quick to bring people in from far, far away who don't know the people that they're serving. We're trying to reach out to partners. Yes, that increases our capacity. Yes, that certainly helps during the catastrophic event, but we're also trying to do this even in the 200 disasters a day, the house fires and apartment fires and single family fires. We want partners who are better demographically able to serve the community to be right there with us, or in some cases instead of us, and represent the community in their response. So that's the tougher organizational change for us. And there's the willingness of the Red Cross to open our systems up to outsiders, to start training other organizations, to give our supply you ahead of time with cots and blankets and what you need to become a shelter. But then there's another half of the equation, and that's when we ask another organization, would you become part of this community's disaster response? We need a commitment. It's not, well, call us and we'll do the best we can with who we can round up when the disaster hits. That's not what an emergency manager wants to hear. They want to know that this community, we can open up seven shelters and staff it to this level. So we're looking for partners that represent who we need them to be, who can help us with firm commitments of resources. That's taking longer, but gosh, we're excited about the progress we've made on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally, I want to talk to you about National Preparedness Month. When we were last here in 2005 talking to Admiral Evans, she emphasized how preparedness begins with the individual and the family and the home. Have you gotten that message across as completely as you would wish?
I think we all need to be honest and recognize that we're just not moving the needle on citizen preparedness like we need to. And we've worked with some very close partners to study why. And is it the message? Is it the messenger? Is it something about the people? Are we not using the right language? Are there larger factors at play here? And we've done some very tangible things, and we've learned some very important things. The first one was right after 9/11, the Red Cross came out with what we called Together We Prepare, which was our five steps for preparedness. After that, Homeland Security came out with Ready, which was the three steps to preparedness. And many communities and some states mounted preparedness campaigns with X number of steps towards citizen preparedness. And I think we made it confusing. I think we made it seem harder than it really is. We felt like we needed to take the lead in arriving at one national message. And it was very clear that Homeland Security was not able to move off of its three steps for preparedness, which is, do you have a kit? Do you have a plan? Do you know how to stay informed? So we adopted that and walked away from our Together We Prepare. We now call it Be Red Cross Ready, which is the same message as Homeland Security. We've worked with a lot of metropolitan areas. We've worked with states, and we've said, can we all have the air cover of a consistent three-point message here and make it simple? And we've had great progress with that. So that's why we changed what we were doing. It was in the greater good of coming up with a common message. We've learned that the two key leverage points for citizen preparedness are kids and employers. If you come home and say, my boss wants me to have a kit and have a plan and know what I'm going to do so that the business can keep running and I know my family is taken care of, then the action steps are taken. When the kids come home from school with a homework assignment, show me your family's disaster plan, we know that steps get taken. And we've got those two key leverage points. So we and others are really focused on corporate partners getting the preparedness message through them to their employees and working with schools to reach kids and working with other organizations that reach kids as well, because we've got to do a better job. I mean, you can look at the data and there's different studies on it, but what percent of Americans have taken a step, any of the steps? It's less than half. It's somewhere between 30 and 40%. What percent of Americans have taken all three steps? It's about 7 or 8%. That's woeful. Mm-hmm. And I know that the people listening to this know better than I do that the true first responders are often the family members. And if they know what they're doing and if they've got a kit and a plan, then they're not part of the problem and they don't need to be rescued necessarily because they've got a plan and they knew what they were going to do about mom who's in the next part of the county and they knew what they were going to do with their pet and they had things worked out ahead of time. We've got to get better at that. And we've got to make sure that we're not throwing good money after bad here by just kind of speaking to everybody about it. We need to understand who the key audiences are, what the right words are, and I think we're about there in terms of understanding how to go about doing this.
Joe, I have one more question before we leave you. Is there anything else you'd want emergency preparedness professionals to know that the Red Cross is doing that helps them with their job and forging the partnerships that you've been talking about?
Gosh, I'd say one real important initiative that we've had for the last 7 or 8 months. I mentioned what we learned from Katrina, and we set new bars. We want to have 6 million prepackaged meals. We want to be able to shelter people for 500,000 people and have those supplies. We felt after last hurricane season, we need to do a better job of quantifying our worst-case scenarios. If the worst thing happened in this metropolitan area, how many people would need to be sheltered? How many people would need to be fed on a daily basis? And so we worked with local and state government. We worked with the other NGO partners, and we started with 6 risk regions of the country. We started with the tri-state area around New York. We started with the D.C. metropolitan area, the Mid-Atlantic coast, the Gulf Coast, Southern California, in the Bay Area, Northern California. And each one had, it wasn't what's the worst thing that can happen here in terms of fatalities or injuries. It was what would stress the mass care systems the most. For example, in New York, the worst case scenario was a hurricane hitting Manhattan. We would have to shelter more than 600,000 people, which would be four Katrinas if that happened. We'd have to feed on a scale that's five or six times what we did during Katrina. These are each our scenarios where we are not ready as a country. Our organization is not ready to be on that scale. States, locals, federal, we're not ready on the worst case catastrophic scale. You know, when Max Mayfield was leaving the Hurricane Center, he did a really good job of trying to convince everybody that we've not seen the big hurricane yet. And he's got data and he's right. As bad as Katrina was, there are scenarios that are many times orders of magnitude of Katrina. We had to quantify those, and we've done that. And it's not just been a Red Cross exercise. It's been a state, local, nonprofit partners, and then we drilled them. We tabletopped them. And out of that came, it's very close to what FEMA's doing with its gap analysis that they've now started. But what we've said is, here's the bar. This is the level of service that would be required in each of these scenarios. Here's our local capacity. Here's the gap. How are we going to fill that gap quickly, particularly on the no-notice event like the Bay Area earthquake, the Southern mm-hmm. California earthquake? And behind that, there's other regions to come. Number seven that we need to do next, we need to go back and revisit the New Madrid Fault Plan. There's a lot of folks re-energized around that. We need to become a better part of that process. But what I think we need to do as a country, and it doesn't have to be a catastrophic, in each community, we need to quantify clearly what our worst case scenario is, how many shelters does that need? How many volunteers does that mean? How many meals does that mean? And if we're not there, what's our plan to get there? It can't always be stuff coming in from the outside and counting that it's going to be there as quickly as it needs to get there. Outside might not be able to get there fast enough. How do we build that local capacity? That's what we've been focused on as an organization, and not just navel-gazing Red Cross, doing it with our partners as well.
Well, Joe, this has been terrific, most informative. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule, especially in the middle of the hurricane season. And many thanks for your service and the service of your colleagues to our country.
Thank you very much.
This has been a Domestic Preparedness podcast interview. Thank you for listening.